I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hello, and thank you for joining us for a very special episode of Pete and Gary's Military History. There are a number of really important anniversaries coming up throughout April and May, so we thought, what better time to revisit some episodes we've done in the past to tie in with these key anniversaries? So please enjoy this special bonus episode of Pete and Gary's Military History.
A Living History production.
I'm Peter Hart, and for the last 40 years, I've interviewed thousands of veterans about their experience of war. Join me on a journey through the pages of history. Welcome to Peter Hart's Military History.
Hello, and welcome to Peter Hart's Military History. And this week, I and my good friend Gary Bain, the eye candy of eye candies, we will be recording Second Battle of Krithia, which is in early May 1915. And I'm really looking forward to this one because it's about Gallipoli, and everyone knows that's my favourite.
Yeah, morning, Pete. I think for the benefit of the listeners, we should say that during the current coronavirus crisis, we're actually recording this remotely. So I had the pleasure of observing you through video conferencing, and you seem to have had a bit of work done at your house. You're coming to me live from the dungeons that you've just recently had fully equipped.
Yes, yes. Well, you need these things. The way my children behave, you have to have some way of restraint, you know.
But, yeah. It's interesting. I can see your wide and varied book collection, but what stands out most, I can see Jutland by you, Fire and Movement by you. Why do you have so many of your own books, Pete?
I have them because, as you well know, I can't remember a thing I've bloody written.
I thought you were the only person who actually bought them.
I'm certainly one of the few to have read them.
Anyway, good morning. So we're talking about the Second Battle of Krithia. So I'll kick off if I can and demonstrate my complete ignorance to begin with. What's the First Battle of Krithia?
Yeah, we skipped one, haven't we? First Battle of Krithia is a sort of encounter battle on the 28th of April. What about they landed? They've taken the ground above the beaches, and then they move forward on the 28th with the objectives, the usual objectives of taking Achibaba, the rest of it. You know, it doesn't go well. It's an encounter battle. They don't get very far forward because they guess who they encounter?
The Turkish.
Yes, that's right. They encounter the Turks, who shoot them, and the attack breaks down. Perhaps we'll come back and do a podcast on it in a couple of years' time. It's not a major battle, although if we do a podcast, I'll be telling them it is. You know, and so the second battle, and then the next thing that happens is there's a massive Turkish counterattacks. The main one is on the night of the 1st of May, and they hit a couple of battalions of the 29th Division, who memorably run away for a while, but then counterattack, which is fair enough. And most of all, they hit the French 1st Division, which is on the right of the line. So that's next to the Dardanelles Straits, as opposed to the Adriatic on the other side, because they're advancing along a peninsula.
And can I point out that you started that conversation with that it was the usual objectives? I mean, how telling is that?
Yes, that is a bit of a sign, Gary, that things aren't going wrong, that things are going wrong. The objectives, as on the landing, originally the landing objective, thank you for prompting me here because I'd forgotten, but the effort is the dominating hill that dominates the whole Hellas Peninsula called Achibaba. That was the first day objective, and it's always the objective from then on. The real objective, the second day objective from the original landings, is the Khalid Bahir Plateau. And once they've got that, they dominate the narrows, and on the third day, the fleet could go through. So they never get to any of those. They never get to Achibaba. So from now on, the objectives are always either the village of Krithia, which is unprepossessing, which is slightly more polite than last time, I think I mentioned it, village, on the way to Achibaba Hill. So, you know, that's the objectives.
And is Khalid Bahir what our good friend Belent refers to as that big bastard?
How rude of Belent. I can't believe he'd say things like that. Belent is the best Gallipoli guide. Well, the best young and virile Gallipoli guide, I think we put it.
Thank you for that.
There is a couple of older guides who are brilliant, but he's our guide. We love him. Anyway, so where are we? What are we going to talk about?
Second Krithia. So who planned it, first of all? Who planned the attack?
Well, it's basically planned by Hamilton, who gives the orders to... So that's General Sir Ian Hamilton, who commands the Mediterranean Expeditionary Force. And he gives his commands essentially to Major General Aylmer Hunter Weston, who is a controversial figure who will be returning to later on. He'd been very rapidly promoted. He was a colonel before the war, promoted to brigadier, did well as a brigadier on the Western Front, some quite innovative things. He always rode a motorcycle. He thought that was a quicker way of getting around than a horse, which is a sign that, you know, something about him. He did well crossing the bridge at the Ain, because he realized as an engineer that it would bear their weight, the men crossing, and he'd done well. But we're coming back to him. But he was the man who did most of the planning. Yeah. We ought to talk about some of the difficulties he was facing, do you not think? Because this is one of the things.
Yeah, so we've both been to Hellas. So what sort of problems did he encounter?
Well, let's talk about the terrain first, because this is quite interesting. Now, you can't... I've got a map of Hellas in front of me. Hello, map. But I've also got my... And this is going to... You're going to think something rude here. I've got my right hand right in front of me. And if you put your right hand out in front of you, it is a map of Gallipoli. Because although it's not mad terrain like Anzac, it is quite interestingly split up. And it's split up by a number of gullies and spurs. So if you put your right hand in front of you, Achibaba is your basically where the bone of your wrist, that's what that's called. Think of that as Achibaba. And then in front of you, you have a series of small spurs and gullies. So if you take them from the right, you have gully spur, that's your little finger. The gap between them is gully ravine. The next finger is fir tree spur. Then you have Krithia Nullah, Krithia spur, Achibaba Nullah, Kerev spur, and then the gap between your thumb and your forefinger is Kerev's Dare, which is a massive... You've seen it, Gary. You've been down it. And actually, due to my brilliant guiding, you've climbed out of it, I think.
Did. It was lovely.
Yeah, lovely, yes. That's not what people say when I say, up there!
And I've told you before, I hate Spurs.
Yes, you have said that. As an Arsenal fan, you do hate Spurs, yeah. Just to explain for anybody Australian who doesn't actually know who Spurs are. Mind you, we don't know any Australian team's names, do we? They're probably called...
The Tigers.
Probably Wanderers, Tigers, Sausages, that sort of name. Anyway, so the back of your hand is a map. Or you can look, we will load a map of the objectives on internet. Is that your right hand? Yes, it is. Sorry, we've got a video link, so we can see.
Yeah, I'm having a look, and clearly my map's in 3D.
Well, that's it. It's a 3D map. Now, there is a problem, because if you're advancing, can you imagine, as if you're advancing up these gullies, then they dislocate you. It means that it's difficult. If you're in one of the valleys, it's the nullahs, it's difficult to see what's going on. It's difficult to maintain a steady rate of advance. It enables the Turks to counterattack either down a spur or a valley, and there's not much you can do about it. It's quite difficult ground. It's not impossible like Anzac, but it's difficult. Now,
What were the Turkish defensive positions like? Because presumably they weren't just sitting there allowing us to merrily climb our way up these spurs.
Well, they're about halfway up. So they're about a mile in front of Krithia, and they have some dug trenches, but a lot of it is improvised at this stage. So they're shallow trenches, or they're using natural features, the edges of woods, that kind of thing. Or on the right, on Gully Spur, they've got Y Beach. Above Y Beach is a natural defensive position. We talked about Y Beach. This is why it would have been useful to have it. The reason they didn't have it is because the Turks took it off them.
And let me get this out there very early, because when we did V Beach, there's the debate about the machine guns. Were there machine gun posts around Helice at this time for Second Krithia?
Yes, they moved up their own, and they had a set of German machine guns off the warships, taken off the warships with German crews. So now there are machine guns. So the whole thing's got worse. The other thing that that Hunter Weston and Hamilton had to bear in mind was that their troops were in a terrible state. So what did they have ashore? They had the 29th Division, and they're pretty exhausted and started to be a little bit demoralized. They've been fighting, if you think of it, almost continuously since the landings on the 25th. And they hadn't exactly had a good night's sleep before that, had they? So they were tired, and they were getting near the end of their resources. The Royal Naval Division, which had no artillery, was split up. It was inexperienced, and they didn't know what they were doing. The old arse and elbow routine is they didn't know their arse from their elbow. And they were in a bad state. They were split up, most of them at this stage attached to the French. The French 1st Division had terrible casualties and was calling for reinforcements. The French 2nd Division wouldn't arrive until the day of the attack, which was the 6th of May. And, the Turks had been reinforced. Instead of just having one battalion, that was all that was there on the 25th of April, they now had best part of 31 battalions, which it works out at about 20,000 frontline troops. They'd lost a lot of men in the attacks to drive us into the sea on the first night of the 1st of May. So it's all difficult. And carry on. Sorry,
I just need to ask, and I'm going to phrase this delicately, but there was a very poor view of Johnny Turk, for want of a better word, and their fighting capabilities on the 25th of April. Had that view changed? The Turk was a very good soldier, and had that been realised?
I think in part. They make this mistake time and time again of underestimating the Turks. The Turks are dreadful in attack. They're brave and courageous. They're a bit like we are. They just charge, shouting to Allah. We shout for God, whichever God, they shout for Allah. Equally useful, I think, in attack. In other words, they get mown down. In defense, though, the Turks were much better than us, I think. They're really good. They're absolutely determined. And the reason they're better is they're tougher.
And they're defending their homeland.
Thank you. Great point. Yeah. And so, Hamilton knew that it would only get worse. There's 20,000 there. It's going to be 30, 40. The Turks are going to feed troops in. So speed is essential. But will he have enough reinforcements? Because his troops are in trouble. And it's always this thing at Gallipoli. Can you attack? If you don't attack, the Turks get stronger. If you wait for reinforcements, the Turks have got really strong. This is going on all the time. And so what he does is swallows his pride a bit, and he calls for the 42nd Division. They're a fantastic bunch. I love them. They're my second favourite division. They're East Lancashire Division, and they're territorials. They've been spending their time training in Egypt since the start of the war. Training hadn't been of much relevance to real warfare. I suppose a lot of them had got VD. Oh, I'm not supposed to say that, am I? Oh, well.
Too late.
But too late. It's gone. The moment's passed. The punters won't remember I said that, will they? When I say punters, it is free. So they were being sent in. So the 125th Brigade, which is part 42nd Division, would arrive on the first day of the Second Battle of Krithia, which is 6th of May.
Now, Kitchener had made it very clear that Gallipoli was to be conducted with minimum forces. And here's Hamilton very early on asking for reinforcements.
Absolutely. And he'd already asked for the Indians as well, a brigade of Indians. It's clear that force generation, which is a crucial part of any operation, had been ignored. They didn't have enough troops and they weren't the right sort of troops. That's because the best troops are on the Western Front, as well they should be. I've got a nice quote from a chap called Lieutenant George Horridge from the 1st 5th Lancashire Fusiliers. And it's a lovely quote. I love George Horridge. He was, I turned up to interview him when I interviewed him. I was young and foolish then. I'd been out drinking in Liverpool till the early hours. Arrived at Bury, where he lived. You know, his house was, I think, Lake Hill, Bury. And he said, hello, young man. He looked at me and said, I know what you need. He recognised I've got a hangover. He gave me a glass of that yellow liqueur. What's it called? Avocado or something. Anyway, it was horrible. You chew it.
Avocado.
You chew it. And I remember drinking this, and hair of the dog doesn't work for me. I just felt worse. Anyway, he said this. On arrival off, I can't do the accent, but on arrival off Cape Helles in daylight, it dawned on one more forcible that this was it. Everyone wonders what will happen when one actually arrives at the war. Will it be horrible? Will one be afraid? Will one be able to carry on out one's duty? Will one be killed or maimed or perhaps only mildly wounded? And that's what's in every soldier's mind before a battle. We've had this before. Hamilton had also arranged for the New Zealand Brigade and the 2nd Australian Brigade to be moved down from Helles, but they wouldn't be there in time, to join in the initial attack. Now, the plans he made, Hunter Weston made these plans, they're completely unrealistic, you know. And one of the, I'm sure Hunter Weston realised this, but he's a can-do kind of general. This is not a good thing. He's over-optimistic. And basically, the French would advance to capture the Kerevs there, looking at your hand. That's the gap between your thumb and your forefinger. And then it would act as a pivot while the British line pivoted on that and moved forward towards the village of Krithia and the hill of Yazi Tepe, which is fundamentally where the knuckle of your little finger is.
And I think the role of the RND was to actually be that pivot on the day, wasn't it?
They were the pivot between the French, yeah. That's it.
We didn't... For the benefit of the listeners, this is over the 6th, 7th and 8th of May, ultimately, isn't it?
First day, it's meant to be one day. It's meant to be the 6th, and they're meant to take Krithia, and then next day take Achibaba, then day after take Gallipoli, and then the fleet goes through, etc. Tea and buttered scones for everybody. Now, the one problem is they still don't know. There's two more problems. They don't know where the Turkish positions are, so it's an advance to contact, which is the worst sort of battle, in my view. It's arguable attacking sometimes when the trenches are really good. But if you don't know where they are, it's a painful business. And we also still had very few guns ashore, and naval gunfire is largely ineffective, especially if people are in the gullies.
And because I know that you like doing this so much, who was in command of the French?
Damade.
Say that one.
Yeah, I can say that. I've got this first name, General Damade, who'd worked well with us in France, had been appointed, and he did work pretty well with Hunter Weston Hamilton.
He would need to, given that plan. You know, the communication with the French is going to be essential.
Yep, they've got to advance up Kerev's spur, which is your forefinger, and then take the and capture the Kerev's air gully, and well, it's basically take the high ground to your knuckle on your forefinger. Now they start a bombard. They're going to attack at 11 all along the line. No subtlety. They're going to attack at 11, and the bombardment starts at 10:30. Now, everybody's late starting off because the orders haven't got through properly. I'm going to read a French quote first, because do you know what? I think it's important, you know, that we reference and look at the French. And this is Lieutenant Henry Fuel, 52nd Battery, 30th Regiment. And he says this: in perfect order, our troops shook themselves out and set out to climb up the long spur that separated them from their enemies. They advanced us on exercise. Our brave troops, no gaps in the ranks, punctuated by flashes of bayonets and the blue glint of rifles reflecting the rays of the midday sun. You would think they were on a training ground. But what is there to say? This wall of steel stops, hurls itself at an obstacle that it can't breach, hesitates, immobile for an instant, then all the geometric lines fall apart. Groups running right, left, thrown into confusion. All the while, Turkish machine guns rattling away, tearing at the air, ceaselessly firing into a wall of palpitating flesh.
Like, wow.
And the point is, you notice they always mention machine guns, and there were machine guns, but it's as much, if not more, rifle fire.
And you mentioned right before that there was a barrage scheduled before the attack. Forgive me, I may be wrong here, but I think, wasn't it contemporaneous to the shell shortage that was being reported on the Western Front? So did they have enough guns, enough ammunition for that sort of bombardment?
Of course they didn't. And that's the stupidity of trying to do Gallipoli at the same time as the Western Front. Yes, there's a shell shortage at the Western Front. We're fighting battles around the Neuve Chapelle area, Festubert, the rest of it. We're completely running short of ammunition, and we haven't got much ammunition here. The bombardment, it would be polite to call it desultory.
So why wasn't one or other of the fronts given priority? I mean, I would suggest that the Western Front should have been given priority and just holding in Gallipoli. You're there, so just hold it. Why did nobody actually say, this is the priority?
They did. They said the Western Front's a priority, but people at Gallipoli wouldn't have it. And this goes on for the rest of the campaign, in particular Hamilton. People always blame Hunter Weston, but in my view, and I like Hamilton actually as a person, whereas nobody likes Hunter Weston as a person, but Hamilton is the one who's just sees only opportunities and doesn't see the difficulties. He always thinks that, you know, just give me another division, two divisions, and I'll do the job. Anyway, so the French make some ground on the right, going up Kerev Spur, but not in the end that much ground. And on their right, the Hood Battalion, part of the 2nd Naval Brigade, which is attached to, it's a sort of composite brigade, which is attached to the French. They're not meant to really move, but they do. And here, Joe Murray takes up the story. Now, Joe, you know Joe Murray. I've been obsessed with him all my life. I read his book. It's here. Next to me, Gallipoli as I saw it when I was about 11. I was a strange child. You were going to say something there. Yes, I'm glad. I had the pleasure of interviewing him in about 1983-4, and he did 21 hours. And you can hear all of it on the Imperial War Museum website. Anyway, Joe Murray said in his impenetrable Geordie accent, he spoke very fast. He's advancing, and he's advancing towards places we've been, so the White House, the Brown House, and he's advancing along Achibaba Nullah, which is the gully to the effectively north, but it's between your first and second finger in your map that I've created for you. He said, and Murray said this: there's no sign of the French. They early on lost touch with the French. It was a beautiful morning. We got to a farmhouse, what was left of them, knocked about but serviceable. We were lying alongside the corner of a vineyard, a bush hedge 3 or 4 foot high, a little ditch on the side. There's a big gap about 12 foot wide. We had to rush along the front of the house and go through this gap. Only 4 people got through. We had to climb over the dead and the wounded. We got about 10 yards in front and down we went. They didn't know where the enemy was. You know, I'm you know, this is me, not him. It's all me, but you know what I mean. They were under increasingly heavy fire, and he found himself with 3 friends, and he gives them names. The names that I'm going to use and he uses are not real. He changed the names because their relatives were still alive when he did his book back in the early 60s. And he goes on, "We crawled up more or less line abreast," that's the three, his three friends and him, "but the bullets were hitting the sand, spraying us, hitting our packs. How about another dash? Off we went. Another 15 yards. One drops. Everybody drops. We got down again. We decided to go a little bit further and all four get up together. Yates was in front and all of a sudden he bent down. He'd been shot in the stomach, maybe the testicles, but he was dancing around like a cat on hot bricks. Fell down on the ground. As soon as we got near him, he got up and rushed like hell at the Turks and bang, down altogether. Out for the count. Young Horton, he was the first to get to Yates. And he got hold of him and sort of pushed him to see what was wrong when a bullet struck him dead centre of the brow, went right through his head and took a bit out of my knuckle. Poor old Horton, he kept crying for his mother. I could see him now, hear him now at this very moment. He said he was 18, but I don't think he was 16, never mind 18. He was such a frail young laddie. And I remember Murray telling me that. He was blind. He had gaps in his vision. He could just see through a little channel, like through a telescope, but he was getting increasingly blind. And I asked him about his memory. He said it was like a cinema show. He could see it in his head. And when he was telling me about that, his voice, you could see he was reliving. He was quite upset. And it is upsetting, you know, this kind of stuff.
That demonstrates that things started to go wrong very quickly between the R&D and the French. And actually, that's critical. Maintaining contact with the French is absolutely critical. And it goes wrong straight away.
Well, when they're going to be the pivot, you know, if you think of your elbow, they are their elbow joint. So, you know, the from your tips of your finger, that's the Adriatic. To your elbow, that's Kerem's there. That's meant to go in a pivot towards the Yazi Tepe.
We don't know where the Turks are. Why is advance to contact so difficult?
It's because you don't know where they are. They're in a ditch ahead of you. You're in the open. They open fire. And before you know where you are, you're dead or not dead.
And there's a lot of references in the quotes, particularly, you know, I revisited Defeat at Gallipoli by your good self. And I nearly said Nigel Steele. And, you know, it actually, there's lots of quotes about, you know, fire from all directions and not being aware of where the Turks are.
That
demonstrates fully the difficulties of advanced contact.
It does. It's bloody awful. And the Royal Naval Division, well, the Composite Brigade, you know, failed to keep in touch with the French, and they stagger to a stop. In fact, they retreat a couple. They get about 400 yards. On the left, they get shot to bits from the positions above Y Beach. So, you know, that's on the gully spur. And in the end, nobody gets further than about 400 yards, you know, which is bugger all.
And correct me if I'm wrong, I think there are two machine gun posts above Y Beach at this stage, aren't there?
Reportedly.
I did say correct me if I'm wrong.
No, I'm good. They always say there's two. But we have basically, this is standard position. You know what you have on your side. Yeah. But what you imagine the other side have is always a little bit of speculation. So I'm always slightly dodgy about that. Sadly, there are not enough Turkish sources yet, and that's one of the great things in Gallipoli studies. And Harvey Broadbent and others have been working on the Turkish archives, and the more stuff that comes out of that, the better. So that's the 6th of May. The total failure is how I would sum it up. 7th of May, Hamilton, he speaks to Hunter Weston and Damard, and then he orders them to do it again. Now, Hunter...
Sorry. You mean exactly the same objectives?
Exactly the same objectives and plan. Now, Hunter Weston always gets the clatter for this. And he says, yes, he does it, can do general. But, you know, who's ordering it? That's all I'd say. Hamilton. By this time, they've had a bit of reinforcements. They've got a brigade of the 2nd French Division and the 127th Brigade of the 42nd Division. Previously, only the 125th had arrived. They'd attacked on the left and nothing had happened. They'd got nowhere.
Experienced soldiers?
These are the territorials of 42nd Division. No, this is their first time in action. Great point. And let's have a look at one of them. Because on 09:45, on 7th of May, the bombardment begins again. Less than ever. Bugger all, you know, in any way as a bombardment. I don't think on the Western Front you'd have even noticed it. And let's go to Lieutenant Horridge, George Horridge, and he's advancing on Gully Spur. That is your little finger in our map of Gallipoli, your hand in front of you. And he says this: "We were told we would advance by platoons in extended order. I was the last platoon but one in the advance. As the distance between Gully Ravine and the sea is some 300 yards, I think it's a bit more than that, but there you are, I had to extend my platoon in two lines, 30 men in each line at 10 paces interval. The scrub was so thick, it was impossible to keep in touch with all the men, and one merely had to blow the whistle and hope that everybody advanced. You had to follow the people in front of you. When you found the line in front, you lay down. When they got up, you got up and continued the line, the advance. And so we got started. There are a few hisses of bullets. As we went further, these got more and more. We came to a trench. Then we advanced still further. The amount of rifle fire we were under seemed to get bigger still. I began to lose control of the platoon because I simply couldn't see them in the scrub. All I could do was blow my whistle, beep, beep, and hope the NCOs were doing their job. Eventually, we got to one trench behind the front line. Next to me was an old soldier called Collinson. We got out of the trench and we had to go at the double because the fire was very heavy. The bullets were hissing round. Swish, 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 swish. We ran halfway and then we got behind a mound. After a minute or so's rest, I said to Collinson, I said, look, we've got to go on. And off we set again. I wasn't too bad a runner. And I outstripped Collinson and we eventually leapt into the front line trench. I'm sorry to say that Collinson, in the last 10 yards, got hit through the chest or stomach. We got him in, but he died later. Now, the point I want to make to you is that all of this advance and all the trenches they cross, they're not trenches so much as ditches, is behind the British front line. And what does this remind you of?
Well, it's a bit like the Newfoundland Regiment on the Somme, 1st yes. of July.
Who gets slaughtered advancing up to the British front line.
Yeah.
And it's the same thing. They're not attacking. They get into the front line. Now, if you're ready and it can have a bash, it's all on one page. This is the second quote from Horridge. And,
So when they finally reach the front line, they're actually helped by the troops that have held the positions overnight in
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to BOLLandBranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Here's a question for the marketers listening. Want to find that perfect customer beyond the world of scrolling, swiping, and searching? Here's a secret to make sparks fly. Smooth talking with podcast ads. With Acast, you can reach millions of listeners who'll be hanging on your every word. On the train to work, in the gym, or waiting in line for coffee. Start up the conversation with podcast listeners anywhere and everywhere. And they're looking for love. 60% of listeners have a higher trust in brands they've met on podcasts compared to social. Get closer to your audience. Make podcast ads with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.
The subsequent attack. And Second Lieutenant George Horridge of the 1st 5th Lancashire Fusiliers says, we got out of the top of this trench. The fellows were firing from the parapet. presumably at the Turks, who I hadn't seen hidden in the bush. But the fire was very, very heavy. We didn't get more than 10 or 15 yards before it was quite obvious that if we didn't lie down, we were just going to be hit. We lay down. You could see the bullets cutting the grass in places. I said to Captain Milnes, "Sydney, do you think we should stop here? What about going down to the cliff?" he said. "Yes, I think perhaps we'd better. It's no good stopping here. We can't go on against this fire. You go first." So I got up and ran to the cliff edge. A fellow called Hudson followed me and he was hit in the neck. What happened to the others, I really don't know. We got under the cover of the cliff edge, got Hudson down to the shore. A naval cutter came and gave us some water, which had some rum in, which tasted very nice. They took Hudson off and we just waited for orders, because what we had to do then didn't concern me as a second lieutenant. Now, that's quite interesting. The water thing's very interesting. I was, you know, you and I have both been there. It's very hot. It's very dry at this time of the year. Water is very, very important.
And it is.
It strikes me that they're bringing water in from the ships. So at that stage, they clearly hadn't sorted out the wells, which we've both seen. And it's really telling that, you know, they're getting down onto the beach before he gets any water.
That's not a beach, by the way. That's just water. It's the edge of cliffs, and it just drops to a sort of thing. But the point is exactly the same. Yeah, we didn't know where the wells were. So we're not locals. One of the big problems is the Turks have put bodies down the wells. And if they hadn't, we thought they had. It's that business. Water, yes. I mean, you know, when we go for a walk, we have a 4-bottle walk, a 2-bottle walk, a 6-bottle walk, and then the legendary boot walk, Souffle, which is an 8-bottle walk, and you probably still run it. But these people had more like 1 bottle per day. You know, these are the little, you know, problems. Anyway, this is Horridge's quote, which I think gives an idea of what had happened and why advanced contact in scrub and rough ground is difficult. He said this: "My platoon had stopped at various places on the way, some at the trenches, some hadn't gone forward. I just didn't know where any of them were. When the battalion was eventually formed up in the dark to go back to the back, of course, they all began to appear. I thought they must have got hurt, killed or injured. It turned out in the end I'd lost 3 killed and 3 wounded out of 60, which is, after all, decimation." And that's interesting because he used decimation in the proper term, i.e. 1 in 10.
1 in 10.
As opposed to the, "Oh, they are all slaughtered. They were decimated." He's using it in the Roman sense of 1 in 10. Mm. Now, the rest of the line we're not going to deal with. It's all the same. You know, there's hardly any advance at all. 200 yards at most, really. And that was, funnily enough, towards on the left, where they make some progress moving towards the top of Y Beach, which, you know, it's a ravine. You know, that's all they make. And do you
and
know
after
what?
After the war, the Turks don't even know that that's a general attack, do they?
You know, you try your best. You attack them all day that day, and the Turks don't really notice. And that, I think, sums up the fighting on that day. And so what do you think Hamilton does now?
I'm slightly concerned here because I know that it's over 3 days. So he has another go, presumably.
And that's it. I mean, it's very difficult for Hamilton. I mean, you've got to look at his difficulties. They've got hardly any artillery ammunition. They gather what they've got for one last effort. They still haven't reached the Turkish forward posts, never mind whatever the main defence line was, which we're always vague as to where it is. The Turks had got another 2 days of digging behind them because we hadn't really involved many of their troops, so a lot of them were just digging the main trenches. It was getting worse and worse on the French front. Because, you know, the Turks were digging redoubts all along Kerev Spur. And we've been to some of them, the Quadrilateral, the Harrico, and then there's another, I've forgotten the name of the other one because I've got no memory. But it's getting worse and worse and worse. But Hamilton still manages to convince himself that it's worth another effort. I think this is criminal myself. But on the other hand, look at what else could he do? Evacuate? Give up, you know, What else could he do? What do you think he should have done? What could he have done?
Well, I personally think there was an argument for evacuation prior to Second Krithia. It's a personal view. You know, they had plenty of artillery there. They had 105 guns and 12 heavies, I think, amongst them. Just no ammunition. And I agree with you. I think it's bordering on criminal at this point to continue to waste lives for no discernible gain at all.
But on the other hand, they'd have lost all the guns. Because remember, they wouldn't have been able to do the evacuation as they did in December and January. They'd have lost most of their guns. It would have been a crippling defeat against a Muslim power. How would that affect India and Egypt? I mean, they never even thought of evacuation. They thought of it the first night at Anzac, but since then it's never been mentioned. But, you know, realistically, I mean, this was probably their best chance before Second Krithia to get away with it. But no, first day of Second Krithia, second day of Second Krithia, that's a bit of a tongue twister. And now the third day of Second Krithia.
And the ammunition diminishing all the time, of course.
Well, they decide to fire off pretty well everything they've got in support of these two. Well, there's basically two attacks on this day. So what's going to happen? Well, they bring ashore the New Zealand Brigade, and that joins the 29th Division. And that puts itself on Fir Tree Spur, which on your map on the back of your hand is the second figure from the right. So it's next to your little finger. That's Fir Tree Spur. It's there's Gully Ravine to the left of it as you advance forward, and Krithia Nulla to the right of it. And what else is happening? The second Australian Brigade are moving up behind the Composite Naval Brigade, and they're basically on Krithia Spur, which is your big finger, your third finger.
And the French are involved all the time, yes? We've not mentioned the French for a while.
Well, we haven't. They're just attacking and having a lot of trouble. Hamilton thinks they've got... He thinks they're on the high ground above Kerem's Dare, but they're not. So he orders them to consolidate, and they're just meant to push across Kerem's Dare. Well, they haven't even got to Kerem's Dare, so that's nonsense. The main thrust of the advance is poor old 29th Division. They're going to tramp once more this wheeling, same wheel, pivoting on the French, you know, at high ground above Kerem's Dare, pivoted across to Yezi Tepe, and then that would be the first day. Second day, take Achibaba. Third day, Kilid-Bahir. And as usual, fleet go through. And this time, I think we'll have beer and skittles. You know, it's the same plan, except for they're not having crumpets. They're going to have beer this time. It's farcical, in my view, as a plan.
And how are they communicating these plans? You know, there's not a lot of time between the 6th and the 7th and the 7th to the 8th of May. I know I'm stating the obvious there. But how are they getting these plans communicated to the people on the ground?
The staff work is abysmal. I'm not sure it's anyone's fault. There's a shortage of trained staff officers. They'd all rushed off to join their units at the start of the war. This is only early in 15, so they haven't really got a new supply of staff officers. And this, of course, is a second campaign. This is, you know, so the Western Front has priority. So Hamilton... So Hunter Weston gives his a warning order at 25 past 11 on the night of 7th of May. But that's only a warning order. But warning what? The formal written orders are issued by 29th Division, his divisional headquarters, 2 hours before the planned attack, so 8:30 in the morning of the 8th. If you look at, say, the New Zealand Brigade, who are now going to attack on Fir Tree Spur, Colonel Francis Johnson doesn't even confer with the battalion commanders till 9 o'clock. And by the time his four commanding officers got back to their battalions, the bombardment has already started. So what time for planning do you think that gives them?
Well, none at all. That's just ridiculous.
So, 15-minute bombardment. What damage do you think that did to Turkish positions when we don't know where they are?
I think the big clue there is we don't know where they are. So the question is, what are you actually firing at?
You're just firing into ground, are you, basically?
Yeah,
I mean, you'll absolutely hit something occasionally, but, you know. So 10:30, over the top again. Now I'm going to concentrate on the New Zealanders this time, because the tale of their attacks on Fir Tree Spur on the 8th is quite dramatic. And Private Cecil Malthus. He wrote a very a good book. And he's with the Canterbury Battalion. Guess where they came from?
New Zealand.
Curses. I was hopefully going to... Yes. And he says this. They get the order. New Zealand is prepared to advance. Where on earth were the enemy? And what were our objectives? Look at that, Gary. Do you see what I mean? They've got the slightest bloody clue what they're doing. Hastily, we threw off our packs. Were they ready? No. And piled them in heaps, which were promptly looted by the Irishmen. That's the Irishmen of 29th Division. And a slur on those gallant gentlemen, I'm sure. It was only in the act of springing over the parapet that we're told of another line of British still lying 100 yards ahead of us. Same thing. Sometimes you wonder how many times these things can be repeated in one bloody campaign. We sprinted the distance, all abreast in fine style. And thanks to our Spartans, it was only in the last few yards that the enemy woke up and loosed his fire. The tragedy of it was that from that moment, he remained awake. In other words, they knew that they were going to emerge from this front line and attack them. And we were left with the certainty in our next advance of having to face a living stream of lead. The real attack, you know, it's tight. They go over again at 10:30. That's when they make their real attack, because that's just advancing to the front line. So are you going to be Cecil Malthus this time?
Yes. So and I want you to
think about... Oh, he goes over the page.
Yeah, I want you to think about the language here and some of the images that Cecil Malthus is painting, because I did read this very quickly while you were speaking, and it's really quite telling. So, Private Cecil Malthus, Canterbury Battalion, New Zealand Brigade. For 200 yards we sprinted, thinking oddly how beautiful the poppies and daisies were. Then, from sheer exhaustion, we rushed to ground in a slight depression and lay there panting. Now the storm was let loose and increased every moment in fury until a splashing, spurting shower of lead was falling like rain on a pond. Hugging the ground in frantic terror, we began to dig blindly with our puny entrenching tools, but soon the four men nearest me were lying, one dead, two with broken legs, and the other badly wounded in the shoulder. A sledgehammer blow on the foot made me turn with a feeling of positive relief that I had met my fate, but it was a mere graze and hardly bled. Another bullet passed through my coat, and a third ripped along 2 feet of my rifle sling. Then the wounded man on my right got a bullet through the head that ended his troubles. And still, without remission, the air was full of hissing bullets and screaming shells.
Well, it sounds terrible.
It's awful.
I mean, you know, as we've said before, there's a place for humour, and this isn't it.
You can imagine the frantic attempts to just, you know, dig a little scrape, because you haven't got to dig a big trench to get below, you know, the danger. And you can imagine they're frantically trying to dig a little into the ground.
And we've both seen those entrenching tools and how useless they are. I mean, they're just little small mixed combined shovel and mini pick. But they're only tiny. They're very difficult. So they dig some shallow pits and get some, as you say.
Well, that would be some relief, I think, from the shells and the bullets that are flying around.
Now, again, they make about 200 yards gains and 100 yards in places. But by now they start to get this thing. They're not level. So across the gully ravine, that's the immediately to their left. Wow. They haven't got as far, so they're getting fired at from the flank. So they're not just getting fired at from the front, they're getting fired at from the flank as well. And it's clear the attack has failed. Now, at this point, Hamilton is already ashore, and he's put himself on Hunter Weston Hill, Hill 114. I think it's that one. I had a sudden moment of doubt. And he was watching the battle there, and now he intervenes. Now, Hamilton is one of those generals who think an army is like a bullet fired from a gun. You point it, you give it directions, but then after that, it carries its own, you know, it's under the command of the people, you know. But he intervenes and orders another attack. Sorry, I know I laughed, but it's not funny.
And well, you're laughing because of how ludicrous it is, because it is ludicrous.
I think it's ludicrous. You know, try. If at first you don't succeed, try again. This is a fourth try because it's two in the last day. He's going to order an attack. He orders the attack at 1600 for an attack at 1730. Now that gives it exactly an hour and a half to organise it. Well, I'm sure that was. They were going to fire every bit of ammunition they could spare for 15 minutes. I'm sorry I'm laughing, but, you know. And the 87th Brigade would attack again up Gully Spur. That's on the right. That's the one between the sea and Gully Ravine. The New Zealand Brigade was to try again and attack up Fir Tree Spur. And they would capture Cruthia, would they? Buggery. The 2nd Australian Brigade was to advance from its reserve position and up Cruthia Spur, which is your middle finger, as far as, you know, right up as far as possible towards Cruthia. The French were to renew their attack of Kerev Spur, and I'm speechless, which is a blessing, but not so good in a podcast, I suspect.
Incredibly ambitious at 1715 in the evening. It's going to get dark. That is incredibly ambitious.
It's wish fulfillment, something. Now, we've got a quote. I think you could be Private Frank Brent because he's a character. Can you do an Australian accent?
No.
I won't even attempt it. So who are you?
I'm Private Frank Brent of the 6th Victoria Battalion, 2nd Brigade, Australian Division. It was indescribable. The noise, the dust, you just couldn't hear each other speak. That went on for about a quarter of an hour. Then everything was as silent as the blessed grave, and that was the time we had to hop out. The barrage had been so heavy that we thought, well, this is going to be a cakewalk. There's nothing to stop us.
Now, I want to make one point very clear. That is because he is totally inexperienced at being at artillery fire and what a bombardment is like. This, you could say, you weren't there, Pete. Well, I wasn't there. But I've heard from that there's a lot of other people talk about this bombardment. And yes, it was the biggest bombardment so far. On the Western Front, it wouldn't have counted for anything. And indeed, when troops from Gallipoli went to the Western Front, they went, I nearly said a rude word, they couldn't believe it.
And presumably, the Navy were lending support as well.
As best they could, but flat trajectory, they can only... Yeah. And same problem, where are the Turks in? We don't know where they are, really. So, you know, it's they're trying. Now, 1730, they go to the top. 87th Brigade fail, just can't get anywhere attacking towards Y Beach, you know, they just go anywhere. Gully Ravine, New Zealanders have another go. Canterbury Battalion have another go. And Captain Frank Gresson, he'd been in the reserve company, and he gives this just standard attack. How many times do we have to hear this sort of thing? I had covered about 75 yards at my top speed when my legs suddenly went from under me as if struck by a hammer, and I fell over and lay still among the daisies. After a few seconds, perceiving that I was not dead but had merely been shot through both legs, I raised my head cautiously and looked about me. The ground all round me was plentifully dotted with khaki-clad figures, for the most part ominously still, though here and there was to be seen one endeavouring to crawl to the trenches in front. Just in front lay the Munster Trench. Again, they're advancing to the front line. And as I looked, one of the men in it beckoned to me with his finger. I made ready to act on it by unfastening my equipment and allowing it to fall off. As I was unable to get up, shot in both legs, remember, I had no alternative but to shuffle along as best I could. And using this mode of progression, I reached the Munster Trench and lay there in great pain, but sheltered from the constant stream of bullets. I mean, again, so he's coming up. He's the reserve company. He suffers. This is all suffered advancing to the existing front line. Tragic, in my view. But now let's turn to the Australians. They're attacking on Cruthia Spur. On your map, in front of your right hand, back of your right hand, it's the middle big finger. And it's bare. It's completely bare. No scrub at all. It's not like that now. So, because now it's got vegetation, woods. It's got a lot of stuff on it now. But then it was completely bare. And all the mistakes are made again. No coherent planning, no organisation. They're advancing under fire before they even get to the front line. And it's just the same. And can you do Frank Brent? You did him so well last time. Can you do this one?
Private Frank Brent, 6th Victoria Battalion, 2nd Brigade, 1st Australian Division. You could see your mates going down right and left. You were face to face with a stark realisation that this was the end of it. That was the thought that was with you the whole time. Despite the fact that you couldn't see a Turk, he was pelting us with everything he'd got from all corners. The marvel to me was how the dickens he was able to do it after the barrage that had fallen on him. I copped my packet, and as I lay down, I said, thank Christ for that.
I think that was a recording done for the BBC Great War series, the original where that quote came from. And I think that's powerful. I think it's powerful. And when you think how scared people must have been, I mean, when you see how scared people are of the coronavirus, and with good reason, but you see that kills the death, you know, we may or may not die of it. But the point is, these people are facing imminent death then, that second, that minute, you know, and almost no way out. And I think when you see how cowardly we are now, you just think, how did these people do it? This is Sergeant Cecil Eads. He's with 7th Victoria Battalion, obviously the same brigade. He said, well, we charged, but, and I love this. This is advanced to contact. Well, we charged, but what we charged, goodness only knows. I never ran so much in my life. Then the machine guns started. That stopped our charging. We advanced by short rushes to within striking distance, but were too decimated, that's the wrong use of the word, to complete the attack. Captain Heron and I happened to be alongside each other, and there was a wretched Turk enfilading us with stray shots. It was dark by this time. Heron and I took turns with a rifle and entrenching tool until Heron got an enfilading bullet over the right eye. I then had to dig for the two of us. We got down to cover without any further mishap. Why the Turks never counterattacked that night and wiped a lot of us out, God alone knows. Think of it, a little band of men, not more than 300, struck right out in front of the army with nothing to the right or left. They got about 500 yards forward and formed a line about in front of Redoubt Cemetery. Now, if you know where Gallipoli, we've been there, Gary, yeah. And I know Matt McLaughlin, I do apologise, Matt, takes tours there, and he's got a wonderful piece, or he used to have a wonderful talk about the whole Australian thing on the internet, which is worth looking at. So they consolidate. That charge, I saw the charge of the Light Brigade the other day. It was on telly, you know, and we've got a bit more time on our hands than usual. And I think it's a pretty dreadful film in some ways. Lots of tight trousers, I noticed. But this charge up Krithia Spur lasts longer, and they sustain more casualties than they ever lost in the charge of the Light Brigade. 1,000 of the 2nd Brigade or 2nd Australian Brigade's 2,000 men were casualties. That's 50% casualties. It's awful. And now, do you know what? The Turkish main battle positions start to be in sight, 500 yards ahead. Roughly, you know, where the Krithia Nullah bifurcates. Well, is that the right word? I think it is. On the right, the French have captured captured La Redoute Boucher. But in front of them, there's still the Haricot and the Quadrilateral. They're nowhere near Kerabstair, you know. And the battle's over. In 3 days, the Allies have lost 6,500 men. And the maximum gain is just about 600 yards. You think it's worth it?
No.
And what more is there to say? Next day, 9th of May, is the time for people to think. And do you think the Allied positions had improved?
No. I mean, we have the advantage. We've been there. We've seen the terrain. And in some cases, I would argue it's actually worse because they're more exposed now. We've been to the Quadrilateral, both cleared and uncleared. And, you know, the French there would have been completely exposed to artillery. So, no, I don't think it's improved at all.
Yeah, the Quadrilateral and the I mean, they're not as developed as it would be. The Quadrilateral and the Haricot, they said it was the shape of a Haricot bean. No idea where they got that. That's a baked bean. Those quadrilaterals still lay ahead of them. And from, they're directing machine gun fire, rifle fire. If you're on the Kerev spur, you're being fired at, not only from them, but from the artillery, as you mentioned, but also from artillery to their right. Because, of course, the French have the Turkish batteries the other side.
Yeah, we were very kind to the French, weren't we?
Yeah, have the position of honour, lads. You have the right of the line, the position of honour. You might find there's a bit, you know, this is all the Turkish batteries firing at them from the, across the straits. So Ian Hamilton writes back to Kitchener, and I can imagine it, that you almost feel like dear dad, because he has a very obsequious relationship. So, dear dad, he doesn't really say dear dad, but he says, the result of the operation has been failure, as my objective remains unachieved. The fortifications and their machine guns were too scientific and too strongly held to be rushed, although I had every available man in today. So you mean everybody was put to the task. He says, our troops have done all that flesh and blood can do against semi-permanent works, and they are not able to carry them. More and more munitions will be needed to do so. I fear that this is a very unpalatable conclusion, but I could see no way out of it. Kitchener was disappointed. What did you say Kitchener said about the whole expedition?
Well, he said that, you know, it should be done with minimum forces. Why didn't he sack him? You know, at this point, why didn't he sack Sir Ian Hamilton? He'd failed. And not only had he failed, he'd overcommitted and he'd gone against it. I mean, Kitchener was very clear, very clear. And now Hamilton's wasted, frankly, what troops were available.
I don't know why I didn't sack him, but I suspect one reason is there's no easy alternative in mind. And remember, Hamilton is the Germans considered him the most experienced general in the world. He'd fought lots of campaigns. I mean, he'd been a British observer at the Japanese-Russian War. He'd been in the Boer War. He'd been in the wars against the Zulus. He'd been in wars against everybody. He's always fighting people, and But guess what? 24 hours later, Hamilton's optimistic again. And this is why I don't like him. It's all wish fulfillment. He wants to maintain a steady pressure against Turks and then renew the full-scale offensive. This will be third Battle of Krithia, which we'll deal with later. And that's on the 4th of June. And he says, if two fresh divisions organized as a corps could be spared me, I could push on from this end and from Gaba Tepe with good prospect of success. Otherwise, I'm afraid it will degenerate into trench warfare with its resultant slowness. You know, and you can imagine what Kitchener thinks, you know, and he can't meet it at full, but he's on 10th of May, he says, I'm sending you the 52nd Scottish Division, Highland Division. No, not Highland. Lowland, sorry. 52nd Division, anyway. Scottish, definitely Scots. And it's too late. They've already got trenches all across. And by the time they get there, by the time of the 4th of June, it's full entrenchments. It's not, you know, improvised defences. It's three lines of trenches.
In my notes, against that decision to send the 52nd Division, I've written the word why. You know, it's... I can't understand Kitchener even considering meeting his request.
And it's going ahead of the story. But when they get there, they're slaughtered. You know, they're fed into the attack piecemeal, and they are slaughtered. It's a dreadful story, Gallipoli, and they keep playing catch up. They say, "Oh, we've got to launch an attack because if we don't, the Turks will get stronger." But the Turks are already too strong for them. That's the reality. They never had a chance. I despair at the can-do attitude of Hunter Wesson and the can-do and the lunacy of Hamilton. I blame Hamilton more than Hunter Wesson myself.
And so, you know, in reality, probably earlier than Second Krithia, but following Second Krithia, had the Gallipoli campaign effectively already been lost?
Yes, definitely. I think it had been lost before. I don't think it ever had a chance of success, given the strength of the Turks and the competence of both their leaders and the troops and the natural configuration of the ground at both Helles and Anzac. But a lot of men are dying, and so there they are. And we haven't mentioned one thing that's going to start, and it had already started, disease. And that we'll have a separate podcast on conditions at Gallipoli, but disease, dysentery in particular, spread by the flies from latrines and from everything. And from then on, as much as you send troops, by the time you've sent them, the troops that are already there are suffering so much sickness that they just top up the numbers back to where they were. And all the while, up on Achibaba, the artillery observers are watching. The Turks are in their lines. They're digging their trenches. They're digging the quadrilateral. They're digging the Harrico. They're digging lines above Kerem's Dere. They're digging lines across the peninsula. They're digging lines here, there, and every bloody where. The campaign's doomed.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Peter. And I look forward to our next video podcast, which I wait with bated breath.
I think you'll find they're not videos.
No, we're videoing.
Yeah, we're videoing. But the punters don't get to see me and you picking our noses. Anyway, thank you very much. And I hope you've all enjoyed that podcast. Thank you, Gary. Cheers, mate.
Cheers, Peter. Take care.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Ando.
And I'm Fer.
And we host Niñas Bien podcast.
We want to invite you to listen to our show.
Niñas Bien means good girls in Spanish. But you have to know that this is not a podcast for good girls.
Or for girls at all. It is a comedy podcast. So everyone is welcome to listen.
We talk about sex, relationships, technology.
We recommend movies and TV shows and discuss pop culture in general.
And there is Chisme Ajeno too.
A section we have just to gossip about everyone. So you'll find something you like here.
And you'll practice your Spanish.
The cleanest Spanish you'll find, we promise.
And if you already hablas español,
vamos a ser tus nuevas amigas. We'll be your friends for the non-Spanish speakers.
New episodes every Monday and Thursday.
Hosted by Acast and available to all audio platforms.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Thanks for listening. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook to learn more about each episode. And if you'd like to support the podcast, you have a couple of options. You can buy us a coffee at buymeacoffee.com/PGMH, or consider subscribing to the podcast for only £2 per month and get ad-free listening and bonus content. You can find links for both on our Facebook and Twitter accounts.
Sounds great, doesn't it?